Hello, my friends. It's Friday, March 21st, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belleville, your Red State refugee, and welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. We've got quite the show to take you into the weekend. If you're having trouble financing the Big Mac brought to you by DoorDash, there's now payment options available. We'll talk about that. Also, a major law firm prostates itself in front of Donald Trump and the movement to resegregate America. We'll talk about the current rift in the Democratic Party of the young, up-and-coming progressive Democrats versus the old, crusty, barnacle, status quo Democrats. Got a lot of clips there to play for you. In our Boycott Idaho segment, we're going to do a follow-up on that teacher, the brave teacher in Meridian, Idaho, the West Ada School District, who is refusing to take down her Everyone is Welcome sign that the school district says violates their anti-DEI policies. And then, at the end of the show, time for a radical rant where we'll learn how MAGA's trying to strike a chord, but it's probably a minor. All the pedophiles are coming out in the MAGA movement. Again, every accusation is a confession when it comes to the right wing. That's all coming up on today's show. But before we get to all that, I just wanted to give a quick note about Elon Musk. The latest news coming out saying that Elon Musk is going today to the Pentagon with Trump to get a briefing on our military's top secret war plans for a potential war with China. Did anyone vote for this guy? Did anyone vote for this guy to get this kind of clearance? And aren't we all kind of shocked that this is happening? I mean, I had thought that in America and in our system of government, there were checks and balances and that there were ways of protecting our secrets and our security. But it appears that the president has the power to just let anyone anywhere. And again, we've known for a long time that presidents have the power to declassify things, but it's just shocking to me that Doge and Elon Musk are able to go to these federal buildings and just bully their way in and get into secret databases and highly sensitive classified information. It's just amazing to me that there's not any better safeguards on this stuff. I was reading the story about the U.S. Institute for Peace, which isn't even really a governmental organization. It's an NGO, a non-governmental organization that's supported by some tax dollars, but not entirely. And the Doge boys were getting the U.S. Capitol Police to help them force their way into these buildings. I just think, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to do when we finally get ourselves out of this MAGA nightmare, you know, assuming that we ever will, is we need to go back and tighten up our laws, our procedures, our security to recognize that there's got to be some better safeguards. So much of our government seems to be predicated on the notion of obeying mores and norms. And just, you know, this is the way things are done. And Trump has come in and proven that you don't have to obey them. And if you don't obey them, that you can run roughshod over our entire federal government. And it's really frustrating because here on one side, we got Trump and MAGA who are just move fast, break things, you know, forget about the law, you know, purge everything and then put stuff back as necessary. It just, you know, that whole tech bro mentality. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, we have a side that's too associated with the norms, too eager to uphold the mores and the way things have always been, the status quo Democrats. We'll talk about that coming up on the show a little later. I just had to mention something about that Elon Musk thing, because it's not as if the guy doesn't have massive conflicts of interest here. His Tesla business has a lot of interest in China with, you know, battery manufacturing and such. That he has been given the access to this high-level military planning should shock all of us. I also wanted to thank everyone for your support of my podcasting hobby. Again, this is just a hobby. I'm not going to be recording ads or, you know, super aggressively promoting this. It's really just a mechanism for me to get my thoughts out, and almost like therapy in a sense. It just makes me feel a little better about the day, and I just like talking to you guys directly, so I appreciate that. I've been having great conversations on Blue Sky with a number of different accounts who've been going back and forth on some of my posts, and I appreciate that as well. If you want to follow me and converse out on Blue Sky, I'm at RadicalRust.com. Also, apologies for the podcast coming out a little bit later this morning than normal, but had to adjust my schedule a bit because we've got my great-grandson staying the night tonight, and or yesterday night and today. My great-grandson Emilio's here, and I know some of you listening are going, wait a minute, great-grandson? How old are you, man? Well, I'm only 57 years old, and I actually don't have any kids of my own. All the grandkids and great-grandkids I have are from my lady love, Lori Duckworth. And Lori had her first daughter as a teenager, and her daughter had her first son as a teenager, or her daughter as a teenager, and her granddaughter had her first son as a teenager. So that's how I ended up being a great-grandfather at the tender young age of 57. And Lori's mom is still alive too. Of course, she's back in Louisiana in Mike Johnson's district. So if we could actually get the granddaughter and great-grandkids from California and Lori and myself all over to Louisiana and get her daughter from Nebraska, if we could all get them in one state at the same time, we could get one of those five generation pictures of great-great-grandma, great-grandma, grandma, mom, and kid. Wouldn't that be awesome? Anyway, been hanging out here with my great-grandson. It's always interesting to have a little two-year-old in the house. Actually, I think he's set to turn three pretty close now. And he saw my studio in here, thought it was quite interesting. So we took a little minute to record a little rap. So here's my great-grandson, Emilio, performing his first rap.
Aw, yeah. Aw, yeah. Go ahead. There you go. Aw, yeah. There you go. Go ahead. There you go. That's right. Yeah. Yep. Aw, yeah.
Okay, I'll admit it. The kid is no Kendrick Lamar. He's got to do some work on, you know, words. But I love him just the same. Now that MAGA has managed to damage and destroy the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that agency brainchild of Senator Elizabeth Warren that had been protecting us from banks and predatory lenders trying to screw us over. Now that they're out of the way, the banks and predatory lenders are out in force trying to find new ways to make sure they can saddle you up with some debt. And the newest development here is in the delivery giant DoorDash partnering up with a financial service called Klarna. You may have seen Klarna if you're trying to buy things online on Amazon or other online portals. Klarna is this service that allows you to buy something and pay it to them over payments. Okay, so like you can purchase something expensive and then they'll let you pay it out in installments. Of course, they got to take their little bit of cut as well. And they take it directly from your bank account. You got to sign up for this to be a direct deposit or direct withdrawal from your bank account, automated clearinghouse kind of thing. So as if we didn't need more debt in this country, we've got Klarna stepping up to help you go in debt on your fast food purchases. As someone on my Blue Sky feed put it, what a perfectly American solution. We have a system that screws the restaurant out of its profits, exploits the delivery driver to deliver it, and puts the consumer of it in debt. So yeah, if you're having trouble spending that $20 to get your Big Mac delivered to your front door, well, you can just put it out over payments, right? This is just terrible what's going on, but it's so perfectly American. It matches what we do in healthcare. It matches what we do in so many areas of American life. And that is putting these rent-seeking middlemen into situations where we don't need them. We don't need to have payments for making DoorDash purchases. And the thing is, it's going to lure in people that aren't very financially savvy. It's the same kind of problem we had at the end of the George W. Bush administration, when the banks were putting together some subprime loans and packaging all of these weird financial packages to put people more in debt, to give them loans they couldn't afford. And people, you know, people are desperate. People don't necessarily understand the consequences of what they're getting into, but they want to be able to present this as the case of freedom. You know, people should be free to make these decisions, and how nice it is that these companies are putting forth, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, these financial instruments to help people get along, when they know that it's going to cause people to go into debt that they can't afford. They know it's going to bankrupt people. They are just preying on us at this point. And as we move forward, and if we get out of this MAGA nightmare, that's again another one of the things that we're going to have to put into legislation. We're once again going to have to rein in these rapacious vultures that are taking our money, taking our health care, that are getting in the middle and not really supplying us with any benefit. They do this all just in seeking profit, and we've got to put a stop to it. Have you been following this story about the executive order against the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison LLP, also known as Paul Weiss? Well, Donald Trump isn't too happy with this law firm, and to fight against it, he produced an executive order. And in this executive order, he notes that Paul Weiss had a partner, a former leading prosecutor in the office of special counsel Robert Mueller, who brought a pro bono suit against individuals alleged to have participated in the events that occurred at or near the United States Capitol on January 6th, 2021. So basically, Paul Weiss had produced an attorney who was doing pro bono work to sue the people who had participated in the January 6th insurrection. Also, the executive order targets Paul Weiss, saying that it discriminates against its own employees on the basis of race and other categories prohibited by civil rights laws. Paul Weiss, along with nearly every other large influential or industry-leading law firm, makes decisions around targets based on race and sex. My administration is committed to ending such unlawful discrimination perpetrated in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, and ensuring that federal benefits support the laws and policies of the United States. Those who engage in blatant discrimination or other activities inconsistent with the interests of the United States should not have access to our nation's secrets, nor be deemed responsible stewards of federal funds. I mean, if you're a South African Nazi, though, that's fine. We can let you have our nation's secrets and be stewards of our federal funds, but not a law firm that's committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this is the game that Trump is trying to play. It's the old right-wing reverse discrimination game. The belief that white people are being discriminated against if we do anything to help black and brown people. That men are being discriminated against if we do anything to help women get ahead. That straight people are being discriminated against if we do anything to help LGBT people get ahead. This is the game that they're playing, trying to say that DEI is some sort of quota system, this targeting system that he puts up, rather than the idea being that some groups are underrepresented. When you look at these law firms, you look at these Fortune 500 companies, their boards of directors, so white and delightsome, so many white men. And it begs the question, gosh, are white men the only ones that have the training and capability? These guys, these MAGA types, want you to say it's all a meritocracy. You want to get through your merit. We want to be promoted through your merit. And yet, somebody who's a four-star general, who's one of the most qualified people to serve as our Secretary of Defense, gets sacked because he's a black guy. And in his place, we put a National Guard guy who was a Fox TV host in his place. That's the discrimination. That's putting white people in places of power based on their race and sex, not their merit. So it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all a big lie. But in this executive order, he threatens this law firm, Paul Weiss, saying that they are going to review all their security clearances so that the firm can't get any security clearance to work with clients that are suing the federal government and need access to classified stuff. They want to make sure that no federal contractors do any business with Paul Weiss, to end all of the contracts with this group, saying that they want to make sure that that Paul Weiss refrains from engaging in any DEI practices. So this law firm, Paul Weiss, very influential, prestigious, and rich law firm, gets this threat from the President of the United States. And of course, being lawyers and standing up for the rule of law, they have, of course, rebuffed this, saying that they would never go along, right? Wrong. Just yesterday on his Truth Toilet social media platform, Trump posted the following, and it was an agreement that has been entered into with Paul Weiss, between Paul Weiss and Trump himself. That's what it says. They've entered an agreement with the president. Let me just read you this statement that these lawyers signed on to, that this big influential law firm signed on to. Paul Weiss agrees that the bedrock principle of American justice is that it must be fair and nonpartisan for all. Our justice system is betrayed when it is misused to achieve political ends. Lawyers and law firms play a vital role in ensuring that we live up to that standard as a nation. Law firms should not favor any political party when it comes to choosing their clients. Firms also should not make decisions on whom to hire based on a person's political affiliation. To do otherwise is to deny some Americans an equal opportunity for our services while favoring others. Lawyers abandon the profession's highest ideals when they engage in partisan decision-making and betray the ethical obligation to represent those who are unpopular or disfavored in a particular environment. Now, that first statement on its face is kind of a neutral thing that you'd think lawyers would support. Of course, they should represent people regardless of what party they are in, and they should help people despite their whatever considerations. They might be unpopular or disfavored, sure. But when you know who this is coming from Donald Trump, and you know the way he frames things, this is basically the law firm saying, we won't discriminate against white people. We won't discriminate against conservatives. We promise we'll be good. Let me continue the statement. Again, Trump is posting this on his social media statement, basically ragging out Paul Weiss in public. Number two. Paul Weiss affirms its unwavering commitment to these core ideals and principles and will not deny representation to clients, including in pro bono matters and in support of nonprofits, because of the personal political views of individual lawyers. This is the setup paragraph of, you're going to take cases from conservatives. You're going to take cases from MAGA. Number three. Paul Weiss will take on a wide range of pro bono matters that represent the full spectrum of political viewpoints of our society, whether conservative or liberal. Again, setting it up, Paul Weiss is going to do pro bono work for conservatives. Number four, Paul Weiss affirms its commitment to merit-based hiring, promotion, and retention, and will not adopt, use, or pursue any DEI policies. As part of its commitment, it will engage experts to be mutually agreed upon within 14 days to conduct a comprehensive audit of all its employment practices. Paul Weiss is basically saying, we're going to let Trump send in a bunch of people like Doge to audit how Paul Weiss hires people to make sure that they're not doing any DEI. In other words, Paul Weiss has handed the keys over to Trump to resegregate Paul Weiss. And that's what's happening here, folks. This fight against DEI, which again is their shortest way to spell the N-word, is all about resegregation. It's all about putting the white man back at the top, unquestioned, unchallenged, and making sure the minorities know their place. So here's the kicker on this statement. Number five, Paul Weiss will dedicate the equivalent of $40 million in pro bono legal services over the course of President Trump's term to support the administration's initiatives, including assisting our nation's veterans, fairness in the justice system, the president's task force to combat anti-Semitism, and other mutually agreed projects. Paul Weiss just rolled over and gave $40 million to Trump as a protection racket payment to keep...
That's a nice law firm there. Be a shame if anything happened to it.
This is mob mentality, and Paul Weiss has rolled over. I hope they gave you knee pads, Paul Weiss. I hope he had some knee pads and he patted you nicely on the head. My goodness, talk about bending the knee. The number one thing in On Tyranny that Timothy Snyder talks about is do not obey in advance. And here they are, obeying in advance. And to support the nation's administration's initiatives to combat anti-Semitism, that's code for round up the people that are protesting Israel's genocide. Round up the people that are pro-Palestinian. Because that's the way they see it. They see if you're pro-Palestinian, if you think that Israel ought not be bombing the hell out of a bunch of children and trying to starve them out, if you think that's a bad thing, why, you hate Jews. Never mind the fact that some of the loudest protesters against Israel and against this cruelty in Gaza are Jews. Jewish protesters are some of the loudest voices. Oh my gosh. So they have some statements at the end here. The White House statement: the president is agreeing to this action in light of a meeting with Paul Weiss chairman Brad Karp, during which Mr. Karp acknowledged the wrongdoing of former Paul Weiss partner Mark Pomerantz. That was the one who did the pro bono work defending the January 6th people. So they're saying that was wrongdoing. That was wrong to give pro bono legal work to the people trying to hold accountable the traitors, the insurrectionists who defiled our capital. Paul Weiss says that was wrong. In response to the president's announcement, Paul Weiss's chairman, Brad Karp, said, quote, "We are gratified that the president has agreed to withdraw the executive order concerning Paul Weiss. We look forward to an engaged and constructive relationship with the president and his administration." How sad to see yet another major law firm bending the knee to this MAGA insurrection, this ongoing coup. I'm continuing to watch the fallout from the disastrous betrayal of the House Democrats by Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. He's been going around all the shows, and the most recent one, he was on MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes, once again trying to defend his decision to end the filibuster and allow the continuing resolution to be passed that gives statutory authority to DOGE and protects them from any congressional oversight. And throughout the entire interview, it was just more of the same. More of the same, where Chuck Schumer is basically waiting for Trump to screw up. Oh boy, when all the people see how expensive their avocados are at the Super Bowl, boy, they'll be mad then. Oh boy, when the Social Security checks stop flowing, they'll sure be mad then. They'll sure know his numbers sure will come down then. Instead of trying to think about how might we make Democrats' numbers go up, how about not being the lesser evil? How about not depending on the Republicans destroying this country and killing Americans in the process and our economy? Rather than waiting for that to happen and hoping that we look good in comparison, why not do something? Why not do something to make us look good in comparison? And the calls are growing. The calls are growing for Chuck Schumer to step aside for new leadership in the Senate. Congresswoman Delia Ramirez from Illinois' 3rd District, at a town hall, when it was asked whether Schumer should retire or step down, said yes. In an interview with Axios, Congressman Glenn Ivey of Maryland's 4th District said, "I've got no personal beef with Schumer. I think he's a talented guy. But for me, the bigger question is he going to do this again? When this comes back up in 6 months, is he going to take the same approach or not? If he's still on that track,
I'm for moving on. Exactly. That's the thing, is Schumer's now destroyed any trust that the House is going to have in him, because this continuing resolution expires in September. We're going to go through this same thing in September. And we've already got John Fetterman, the senator out of Pennsylvania, saying, I will never, ever, ever, ever vote to shut the government down, which AOC rightly pointed out. Oh, so you'll sign the next CR if it's got a national abortion ban in it? Talk about bad negotiating. Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado was in another town hall meeting, asked whether Schumer should step down, and he said, let me just say it's important for people to know when it's time to go. We're going to have a conversation, I'm sure, in the foreseeable future about all the Democratic leadership. And also on MSNBC, Jen Psaki, who has a show there, she was a former White House press secretary under President Biden. She published an op-ed claiming that Schumer is no longer in his prime. She wrote, quote, so where does this leave the Democrats at this moment? Well, instead of making tweaks at the margins of the message, which is important too, maybe it's time to throw out the old playbook and start thinking about new messengers. The young progressive groups are behind that idea. There's an open letter being published by College Democrats of America, the Sunrise Movement, United We Dream Action, and the Voters of Tomorrow, calling for Schumer to fight for us or step aside. Now, I talked about this yesterday, how Schumer is a part of this class of Democrats that suffered through the electoral shellackings of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, where he swept the board of almost every state except for two or three in 1980, and then in 1984 came back and really swept the board, winning 49 out of 50 states. And in my mind, the Democrats in their 70s and 80s still have post-traumatic stress over that. I think that period of time in the 80s convinced them that the country is center-right. It convinced them that, well, they like Reagan because of the conservatism. We got to be more conservative. We got to move more to the right. We got to be more patriotic and wave the flag. And so they always start from this position of believing they have to convince the American people to get on board with the Democratic policies, when in fact, supermajorities support most Democratic policies. Now, it's not just Chuck Schumer who's in this cohort, and it's not just Democrats who are in this cohort. I wanted to play a clip for you of Charles Grassley, Chuck Grassley, who is recently at one of his town hall meetings.
I want to make it very clear that Musk has no power.
That's Chuck Grassley trying to gaslight people at an Iowa town hall that are concerned because they see Elon Musk running roughshod all over our government, and nobody voted for Elon Musk. This is starting to ripple through Republicans now, and they're bringing it up at the Republican town halls, and people like Chuck Grassley are trying to gaslight him, say, oh no, Musk, you know, he got no power. Musk is Schrodinger's administrator. He's got all the power in the world when it comes to breaking into buildings and getting into databases and accessing our federal treasury. But when it comes to accountability, oh, well, that's some lady over here that nobody's ever heard of. She's in charge, except there's no real organizational charge or anything. You can't really pin any responsibility on anybody. Schrodinger's administrator. But Chuck Schumer is just another one of these guys. He's 91 years old, Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer has been in the Senate since 1981, the same class as Chuck Schumer. Chuck Grassley, Chuck Schumer, it was the year of the Chuck. 1981, they've been in the Senate since I was a freshman in high school. And before that, Grassley went to Washington, D.C. in 1975 as a member of the House of Representatives. And before that, he went to the Iowa House of Representatives in 1959. This man's career is retirement age. His career is 66 years old. And look, you know, I don't want to be ageist about this, but there is something to the fact that these guys hang on way too long. We can look back to our side of the aisle. Dianne Feinstein, the late senator from California, They were playing Weekend at Bernie's with her. They were propping her up in meetings. She was clueless about where she was. She should have been in hospice at the time.
Oh, we got to have that seat. Got to have those votes.
So something needs to be done about this, because there's something about being in Washington, D.C., especially in the Senate, that caused these people to become barnacles to our political body. Hanging on and existing in a time that no longer exists, unable to meet the needs of the modern society. Now, I don't think necessarily that being old means you can't be in touch. I mean, Bernie Sanders, pretty old, seems to be in touch with the modern movement. It can happen, but there's got to be some sort of mechanism here, because what we've found over time is that they get ensconced in office and they never leave. Or if they do leave, they then become lobbyists for the very companies they were just trying to regulate. I'm not sure what the solution is. A lot of people put out the idea of having term limits. I don't know for sure. We've got term limits on the president. If we're going to have term limits on the highest office, why shouldn't we have term limits on all of them? I have long proposed that we ought to have a federal term limits amendment, and that what it would do is it would make it so that you could only serve two terms, in any office. Or let's make it 12 years. 12 years in any office. Okay? So you could go to the House of Representatives. You could get reelected 6 times, right? You could be elected to the House of Representatives 6 times, 12 years total in the House of Representatives. And then you got to move up or get out. You could move up to the Senate, like Chuck Grassley did, and serve in the Senate for 12 years, 2 full terms. But after that second term, you got to move up or move out. Maybe from Senate, you move on to become the president. And under my federal term limits amendment, I would have it supersede the 22nd Amendment, limiting the president to 2 terms. I'd have it, again, 12 years. Let him run for 12 years. You can get elected 3 times the office of president, but after that, got to move up or move out. And let's apply this same 12-year principle to the federal bench. You can serve at the district court for 12 years, but then you got to move up or move out. You can serve at the appellate court for 12 years, but then you got to move up or move out. You can serve on the Supreme Court for 12 years, then move up or move out. In such a scenario, a guy like a Chuck Grassley, who makes it to 91 years old, could serve his entire life. I do think there is some benefit to having older, experienced people in office, that institutional memory you can have. But again, move up or move out. You can serve 12 in the House, serve 12 in the Senate, serve 12 as president. You've got a 36-year career. Same thing for the courts. 36-year career from the appellate, the district court, to the appellate, to the Supreme Court. Hell, do like Taft. Serve as president and then move on to the Supreme Court. I don't care. But let's make it so these people have to move up or move out. Have to prove themselves at a higher level. Rather than, like the Peter principle, rising to the level of their own incompetence and then staying there forever. But I don't think we're going to get a federal term limits amendment anytime soon. So maybe, maybe we could have George Clooney write an op-ed. Yeah, maybe George Clooney could write an op-ed. Gee, Chuck Schumer, you're just so old. Maybe someone else ought to step up. And speaking of people who ought to step up, I was listening to some podcasts the other day, and I got to hear the Bulwark podcast featuring an interview with Maryland Governor Wes Moore, who now is quickly rising to my top 5 list of favorite Democrats, right up there with AOC, Jasmine Crockett, and Jamie Raskin. Fantastic, this interview with this guy and his background. Just amazing background, rising out of abject poverty, single mom, joined the military, became a successful businessman, ran for office, and by all accounts is a great governor of the state of Maryland. They've got that key bridge reopening. You remember the bridge that got knocked down just a while back? They said it was going to take 11 months to repair it. They got it fixed in 11 weeks. This guy is moving, and he had some great insights on this podcast, one of which is he said
that the genius of Trump politically, the genius of Trump is that he was a perfect vessel for voters' frustration with the status quo, but he is not the vehicle to the solution. A perfect vessel for the frustration, but not a vehicle for the solution. And that rang so true to me. Because what I have been seeing, politically speaking, since about Bill Clinton's time, is an electorate out here of working class people, of poor people, of generally left-leaning people, who are waiting and just yearning for a Democratic Party that has our best interests at heart. In 1992, we were all worn out over 12 years of Reagan Bush. Along comes this young guy from Arkansas playing the saxophone, seemed cool. A whole new generation. Youth, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. We were all excited about it. We gave Bill Clinton the presidency. What do we get repaid with? NAFTA. Don't ask, don't tell. Defense of Marriage Act. The crime bill. All of these things that NAFTA, that sent the working class's jobs away, the crime bill that put the poor people in prisons, the ramping up of the drug war. Did you know that Bill Clinton's administration tried to shut down medical marijuana? Tried to squash it federally by banning doctors in California from talking about the medical uses of cannabis to their patients or recommending its use to them. And threatening their DEA prescription licenses if they did so. Yeah. Yeah, the Democrats. The Democratic Party went out of its way to the voters of California who had approved by initiative the right to be able to use cannabis as a medicine with their doctor's recommendation. Clinton went out of his way to threaten their prescription rights if they talked about marijuana. That was the first betrayal for a lot of us out here. That was the first time those of us who had supported Democratic politics and supported the young guy and thought we were going to have hope and change, that was our first betrayal. It's like, oh yeah, more of the same, Republican light. Now, Clinton managed to win re-election in 96 against Bob Dole, the least compelling candidate the Republicans have put up in a long time. But again, a lot of what was floating Bill Clinton through the 90s was the booming economy, the dot-com boom. And to be fair, Democrats are better on the economy. Economy does better under Democrats. It's just a fact. But as far as the people and our yearning for change, we felt betrayed. Along comes George W. Bush. In 2000, young guy, kind of guy you'd like to have a beer with, versus Al Gore, the professor who's lecturing you about climate change and how terrible things are. And again, I love Al Gore. I wish he would have been president, but we lost. Over the next two elections, we had George W. Bush. But then in 2008, along comes Barack Obama. And I think it's important to recognize, because we look back at this, look back with the rose-colored glasses of Obama and the historic change of having the first black president, etc., and how great it was, etc., etc., how charismatic he was. But we forget sometimes that he wasn't supposed to be the nominee. The Democratic machine had Hillary Clinton all lined up, ready to go. And I think a major part of Barack Obama's success in 2008 was the rejection of Clinton-type Democrats, the rejection of that neoliberalism. Because we had been through 12 years of Reagan and Bush, and then 8 years of Clinton, and then 8 years of Bush, and then the Democrats were putting before us the possibility of another 8 years of Clinton. Clinton-Bush, Clinton-Bush. The status quo. The two sides of the same coin, the two wings of the same bird. That's what it felt like in 2008. And as it was going through and all the media and the Democratic operatives out there, you know, it was fait accompli.
We'd have our first women president. Hillary Clinton will get the nomination. And Barack Obama came out of nowhere. Unknown senator from Illinois who first got prominence in the 2004 DNC for John Kerry when he made that amazing speech at the DNC. And that ignited a spark amongst us on the left, amongst Democratic supporters. Think, aha, yes, finally, we're going to get away from that Clinton-type neoliberalism and hope and change and si se puede. And we can do it. Yes, we can. We're going to close Gitmo and we're going to raise the minimum wage. And we're going to end that warrantless wiretapping of George W. Bush. We're going to stop these ridiculous wars. And what happened? Obama won and then immediately tacked to the neoliberal center. We're not closing Gitmo. We can't raise the minimum wage right now. Codify Roe. Why? We have other priorities. And once again, it felt like a betrayal. It felt like we got lured in with the, oh yeah, we're going to have hope and change. We're actually going to upend the status quo. We're going to do something different. We're going to fight for the people, for the poor, for the working class for once. Nope. Back to talk about the middle class. Back to talking about business and small business. Nothing for the workers, nothing for the poor. So, we have a situation here where the people are hungry, are eager for this change. And we saw it in the rise of Bernie Sanders in 2016, where once again, they put Hillary Clinton out there. Let's try it the third time. Let's do neoliberalism the third time. Let's go back to the status quo that we all enjoyed under Bill. And who was filling arenas, having viral moments with little birds landing on their lectern? Bernie Sanders, because he was out there talking about the 99%, talking about overthrowing oligarchy, identifying the enemy, the hyper wealthy that have so much control over our politics to the point where they get everything they want and we get nothing. There's a reason why Bernie became so popular in 2016 that he threatened the Clinton campaign. But we know how that turned out. Hillary got the nomination because, you know, oh no, America's far too center-right to elect a socialist. So we got Hillary Clinton, who lost to the worst human being ever, Donald Trump. And I know she got 3 million more votes. She didn't get them where she needed them, like in Wisconsin that she failed to visit. And so now we've had the 4 years of Trump. We had the 4 years of Biden. But again, the Biden thing tacked right back to the neoliberal center. I know Biden did some great things. He did the CHIPS and Science Act. He did the infrastructure law. But how does he go and promote it? That it's the bipartisan infrastructure law. That we had help from our colleagues across the aisle. That we worked together for bipartisan solutions. Gee, I wonder why people have a negative view of Democrats. When Democrats do something good, and they say that Democrats and Republicans both did it. The person says, oh, well, Democrats think both Democrats and Republicans are good. And then the Republicans come out and say, Democrats are evil, they're destroying their country, they're a bunch of pedophiles, and we're the good guys. So, from one side, you get Dems are good, Republicans are good. From the other side, you get Dems are evil, Republicans are good. Gee, it seems like both sides think Republicans are good. Or you'll get someone like Hakeem Jeffries talking about the extreme MAGA right, the extreme Republicans, the extreme far-right Republicans. Which gives the average voter who votes Republican the excuse to say, well, you know, not my representative. He's not one of those extreme ones. Or not me. I'm not extreme. It's, you know, not me. And again, if you talk about how bad the extreme MAGA Republicans are, implied is that the non-extreme, non-MAGA Republicans are okay. When there is no daylight between them anymore, they are all the same thing. You got to name the enemy. So, we got people like Wes Moore, governor of Maryland, who's stepping up. We've got AOC, Bernie, and Tim Walz filling arenas, right? Filling arenas right now with their
oligarchy tour. And I want to play this clip from AOC, who gives you an idea of what it is we're looking for.
You know, Fox News and the right wing will have you believe that these American values are something out of the Communist Manifesto. That we believe these things because we went to college and read them in a book somewhere. But let me tell you, Fox News, I don't believe these things. I don't believe in healthcare, labor, and human dignity because I'm a Marxist. I believe it because I was a waitress. Because I scrubbed toilets with my mom to go to school. Because I've worked double shifts to keep the lights on. And because on my worst day, I know what it feels like to feel left behind. And I know that we don't have to live like this anymore, Las Vegas. We deserve better than this, Las Vegas.
Yes, and what she was talking about are the things she believes, that a minimum wage should pay the minimum expenses needed to live, that someone who gets sick shouldn't go bankrupt in the wealthiest country in the world. Basic things that we're looking for. And again, drawing crowds, pointing out that we could have a government that actually works for us. Raise the minimum wage to $25. Give us parental leave. Get us free health care. We have all the abundance we need to get these things. It's just a matter of redistribution, of making sure all the people can get it. And it takes me to this other point I want to make about the Democrats and the status quo. Because that's the rift right now in the Democratic Party, is the status quo Democrats who want to do things the way they've always been done, follow the rules, the norms, the mores, hope for the Republicans to just get bad enough so that the Democrats look okay, versus these new young Democrats who recognize that the status quo is broken. This is something that Wes Moore was saying on the podcast the other day. The status quo is broken. And if you're seen as defending the status quo, you're going to lose. Just like Kamala Harris did. The moment Kamala Harris lost the election was that interview on The View. When I think it was Sonny Hostin who said it, who asked the question. When you look back over the Biden administration over these past 4 years, are there any things that you would do differently? Kamala Harris said something like, no, I can't think of anything. I can't think of anything I'd do differently. That cost her the election right there. That was it. That cost the election because, again, the people see the status quo as broken. Biden was fine as a president, maybe one of the better presidents of my lifetime, but people were still getting paid $7.25 minimum wage. And when we have Democrats that are supposedly fighting for us, Chuck Schumer, who's been going around the talk shows saying, I'm a fighter. I'm the fighter. Nobody knows how to win Senate seats better than me. I'm a fighter. Guy couldn't win a fight with a Senate parliamentarian over a $15 minimum wage, which, again, is still too low. Be nice to raise it to 15, sure, but it's already 15 here effectively on the West Coast. All the fast food gigs, all the entry-level gigs you would get around here pay at least $15 an hour or they can't get anyone. Democrats have been in the fight for 15 for so long that now 15 is worth what almost the 725 is worth in the minimum wage when it got raised in 2009. Because Democrats don't understand they need to fight against the status quo. And when I look back at the election results, I notice an interesting pattern, right? When Carter won his election in 76, he had 27% of the eligible electorate voting for him. By 1980, it dropped to 22%. Only 22% of the eligible electorate voting for Carter. 27% went to Reagan in 1980. In the following election, 31% went to Reagan, and the same 22% went to Mondale. So over the first term, over Reagan's first term, he got people more excited about him to serve a second term. He got more support in his second election. And then when it comes to 88 and George H.W. Bush, he got 28% of the electorate, which was a decline from Reagan, but still better than Reagan's first term at 27%. So Republicans
don't lose much ground term over term. Now, move to 92. Bill Clinton won with 25% of the electorate. And partially, the reason he won with only a quarter of the electorate is because Ross Perot showed up and got 11% of the electorate. Ross Perot, this nobody from nowhere businessman that no one had ever heard of, but he was not the status quo. 11% of the people, one out of nine voters, eligible voters, were ready to upend the status quo and elect someone not the Republican, not the Democrat. Ross Perot got the greatest amount of 30-party support of my lifetime. Bill Clinton got 25%. In the following election, in 96, Bill Clinton got 25% of the vote. 25% of the electorate. So he did not improve term over term. Then we move on to the Gore Bush election. George W. Bush got 26%. Al Gore got 26.2, but Gore lost because, you know, the Supreme Court decided. Then in the following election after that, George W. Bush's total proportion went from 26% to 31%. Once again, the second term for the Republican garnered more support. My theory behind this is that Republican voters in the first term vote for their guy, and then when he gets into office, he does the stuff they want. And that makes them support him more. He gets more support the next term. Happened for Reagan, happened for Bush. Whereas the Democrats, Bill Clinton, Democrats get excited to vote for Bill Clinton. He gets into office, taxed to the right, and then in the following election, doesn't get any more support. And in a sense, kind of loses support because that Perot number dropped as well. Let's go to Barack Obama. Barack Obama, the most popular president. In his first election, he got 33% of the eligible electorate. One out of three people who could vote voted for Obama. McCain got 28%. In the following election in 2012, Romney got 28%. So the Republican level stayed the same at 28%. Obama dropped to 30%. 3 points worth of his voters stayed home in the following election. Which brings me to a comment one of my followers on Blue Sky wrote. I thought this was great. Bill the Pony put out that voters don't swing from Democrat to Republican. Voters swing from Democrat to couch. Ooh, yeah, absolutely. That's what happened with Obama. One term in, Mr. Hope and Change didn't change much or offer much hope. And he lost 3% of his support. He lost support amongst Democrats. Now we move on to the 2016 election. Trump got 28% of the vote. The same 28% that Romney got, the same 28% that McCain got. Hillary Clinton got 29%, 1% less than Obama in 2012, and 4% less than Obama in 2008. So over three successive elections, Democratic support dropped and Republican support remained the same. Now we move to 2020. And again, Joe Biden did win 2020. 34% of the voters voted for him. But the interesting thing is, in his loss, Trump got 31% of the vote. Trump increased the Republican support from 28% to 31% after his first term in which he had killed a million people with COVID, stared directly at an eclipse, offered fast food hamburgers to the sports teams that were the champions that year, tried to strong arm Ukraine, got impeached twice. After all that, Trump's support went up from 28 to 31. Biden won, but again, a lot of that has to do with we increased vote by mail due to the pandemic and made voting a lot easier for people. So, Biden's in office in 2020, having gotten 34% of the vote. How did it go in 2024? Harris got 30% of the vote. Once again, a Democrat's in office, and the next election, the Democrats lose ground, lose voters. Because we get excited about electing him. And in the case of Biden, I believe the excitement about electing Biden was eliminating the status quo of MAGA to make MAGA go away, to prosecute January 6th, to put Trump in jail, to end this lawlessness. What did we get? Merrick Garland dragging his feet, going for the low-level prosecutions first that are now all pardoned because you didn't bother to take out the king. And whoa, what a contrast we've got in attorney generals, right? MAGA goes and storms the Capitol, threatens the lives of the Speaker of the House and the Vice President, smears shit on the walls, beats the police, pepper gas, pepper spray, tear gas, all that stuff. And Merrick Garland shuffles his feet and can't get around to prosecuting the leaders of it. Meanwhile, these days you look at a Tesla wrong and Pam Bondi's got you on charges. Yeah, amazing that stuff, huh? How they've used all sorts of these forensic techniques and license plate readers and facial recognition technology and fingerprints and tips and managed to find the people that throw firebombs at the Teslas in Las Vegas and these other places. We got them immediately. But someone walks around the Capitol on January 5th setting pipe bombs, and we've got video of them, and boy, we just can't figure out who that was. I wonder who might have done that. And in that 2024 election, Trump support went up to 32%. In 2016, he had 28% of the voters. 2020 had 31% of the voters. 2024 has 32% of the voters. He continues to grow in support amongst his voters. And our voters decline in support after one term. It's amazing. The Republican comes in for one term, does what they say they're going to do, and they get more support. Meanwhile, you get a Democrat that comes in for one term, fails to do what they say they were going to do, and, well, here we are. Today in our Boycott Idaho segment, we're following up on a previous segment where we described the teacher in Meridian, Idaho, the West Ada School District, who had been counseled by her administrators to take down some posters in her classroom. One is a poster that says, "Everyone is welcome." And it features hands reaching up, black hands and brown hands and white hands with little hearts in the middle of the palm. Everyone is welcome here. And the other sign had to do with everyone's respected, tolerated, etc. And it's listed in rainbow colors. So those had to come down because of the state of Idaho's laws against promotion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, the anti-DEI statutes in the state of Idaho. Now, the teacher, her name is Sarah Inama, initially took down the posters, but then that night had a case of conscience and decided she was going to fight back, and she put them back up. Now the school is giving her till the end of the year to take down these posters, and the story has gained national prominence. All In with Chris Hayes did a segment. There's been some others that have discussed this. She was on the Today Show as well, or today.com, I should say. And the teacher points out that nobody had complained about these posters. It wasn't like any parents came in and said, you've got black hands and brown hands, and that's not right. And she also points out that, and this is her quote on today.com, "Since the sign is emphasizing that everyone, in regards to race or skin tone, is welcome here no matter what, immediately I was like, the only other view of this is racist. And I said, that sounds like racism to me." So the school district is fighting back on this. Marcus Myers, who is the West Ada School District Chief Academic Officer, was interviewed by today.com. And he says that what might be controversial now might not have been controversial 3, 6, or 9 months ago, and we have to follow that. So in other words, since Trump is set to resegregate America, we've got to go along. And this Myers, Marcus Myers, was interviewed on a podcast called The Ranch Podcast, where he let the cat out of the bag. I mean, they said the quiet part out loud. He said the issue with the poster is not the message that it displayed, that everyone is welcome. And in fact, the teacher had pointed out that the school district has their own motivational posters, they point out, that say similar things. Everyone is welcome. The guy said, Marcus Myers said, that it wasn't that the opinion that everyone is welcome here was the problem. The problem was the hands belonging to the children of different races. If we didn't show all the black and brown and white hands, then it would be okay to see everyone is welcome here. And they're trying to frame this as if we can't put this up because there's a difference of political opinion. And the only thing I can surmise is the difference of political opinion is that some of the brown hands should be deported. That's the only thing that they could be thinking here. So I'm excited to tell you all that this has taken off in the state of Idaho. I was talking to my mom yesterday, and mom still lives in Nampa, Idaho, which is just west of Meridian, Idaho. And one of the women that she's acquainted with there in Nampa is working with a friend of the teacher's, and they're putting together t-shirts. They want to print t-shirts up that have the sign on it, everybody is welcome, or everyone is welcome, with the black, brown, and white hands. And mom tells me the orders for these t-shirts have gone through the roof. There are over 12,000 orders now from all over the nation and around the world. They're getting international orders for their Everyone is Welcome t-shirt. Brigade Screen Printing in Boise has been shipping the t-shirts as far as Vermont, but also they're printing them up for a local campaign because right now all the kids are in spring break. And the plan is to get as many of the kids as possible in these shirts and have all these kids going back to school on Monday the 24th wearing the Everyone is Welcome t-shirt. If you want to get involved, if you're there in the Idaho area, there are mass pickup events for the shirts. Christopher Lucky Stewart posts on Facebook, we need some volunteers for the mass pickup event this Friday and Saturday, Friday 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday noon to 8 p.m. You can sign up for two-hour shifts, so jump in where you can. We'll be handing out close to, if not more, than 10,000 shirts to let the world know Idaho is a welcoming place. So it's backfiring here on the West Ada School District. And I can't wait to see the video coming out of Idaho from all these kids and all these people showing up with their Everyone is Welcome Here t-shirts. We'll let you know what happens on Monday and Tuesday's podcasts. Mag is trying to strike a chord, and it's probably A minor. Have you caught up on the latest news from the pedophiles in the Republican Party? Oh, my goodness. All right, so let's catch up. The MAGA influencer known as Raw Ricky has been indicted Tuesday on federal charges of procuring child sex abuse material. That's right. Child sex abuse material. By the way, it's no longer called child porn. If you're wondering why you keep seeing child sex abuse material or CSAM, C-S-A-M, they don't call it child porn anymore because porn is something that people do as an art form for adults to enjoy. And so calling it child porn makes it sound as if the children were voluntarily involved in this. So no, it's not child porn. Porn is something that is for adults to consume. Child sexual abuse material, on the other hand, is a crime. So this guy, his real name's Ricky Nguyen, Raw Ricky. He's got over 100,000 followers on Instagram. And what he built his following on was being cruel to homeless people. Yeah, basically his gig was in San Francisco to find homeless people and film them taking drugs or, you know, offer them money to do embarrassing or rude or lewd things. Yeah, a real winner, this guy. So this Raw Ricky was already being investigated by San Francisco police at the time of his arrest and was named in the sexual assault of a 15-year-old. They found evidence on his cell phones indicating that he was facilitating sex work operations that spanned multiple cities. So the guy's a pimp. Guy's a pimp and a producer of child sexual abuse material and producing it with himself. He filmed himself with two different minors. He's currently in federal custody and, if convicted, would face the maximum of 30 years in prison and $250,000 fine. And not only has he been a social media influencer, he's also been a guest on Fox News. He appeared on the Jesse Waters primetime program and Tucker Carlson Tonight. Yeah, folks, you scratch a MAGA, there's a chance you're going to find a pedophile. And you know it just from their constant objections, their constant screaming about pedophilia. That the Democrats are all pedophiles. The Democrats are running pedophile sex rings out of the basement of the Alamo or pizza parlor or someplace. All these ridiculous accusations of pedophilia when the leader of their party is a pedophile. Donald Trump has bragged about sneaking in to the backstage of the Miss Teen USA pageant that he owned, where the girls were in various states of undress and they let you get away with it because I'm the head of the he's peeping on naked teen girls. He's often talked about his lust for his own daughter, Ivanka. There have been 26 women that have filed complaints against this guy for sexual abuse. And he was adjudicated of raping E. Jean Carroll and then defaming her over it. So methink the lady doth protest too much here with all the MAGA that are all up in arms about pedophiles and sex trafficking. When their own party is knee-deep in it, let's also, what's the other story from this week? Justin Eichhorn, the Republican Minnesota state senator. This is a guy who authored a bill on the same day he's busted for trying to facilitate sex with a teenager, someone he knew was a teenager. Like, in the text, he's asking, so when do you turn 18? So he's busted for this on the same day he was one of five co-sponsors for a bill in Minnesota to declare Trump derangement syndrome a mental illness. Yeah. Busted for trying to pick up in one of those Chris Hansen to catch a predator situations, like one of them stings. They caught him trying to hook up with a teenager. This is a guy who also authored a bill, an anti-trans sports bill, that would require a physician to do a genital check if there was a dispute about a student athlete's female sex. Yeah, the guy authored a bill to say, all right, if there's a track meet and someone complains that muscular girl over there isn't a girl, she has to go in the tent with the doctor so he can look at her hoo-ha. These guys, man. Not just Justin Eichhorn, though. How about, this was just last week, Robert Morris. Talked about this because that name is pretty special to me. I've got a cousin named Robert Morris, won a Super Bowl with the Colts. He goes by Rob, though. This guy is a pastor of a Texas megachurch. And Donald Trump's former spiritual advisor turned himself into Oklahoma authorities on child sexual abuse charges. The charges in the allegation is that he met this girl when he was 20. And she was 11. He was 20 and she was 11, began sexually assaulting her when she was 12 years old, and it continued over the next 5 years, from age 12 to 17. In a statement released last year, he said, quote, "It was kissing and petting and not intercourse, but it was wrong. This behavior happened on several occasions over the next few years. Since that time, I have walked in purity and accountability in this area.
Yeah. Churchy. Jesus forgave me. Yep. I was, you know, getting to third base with the teenager for 5 years, but, you know, it's all good now because Jesus forgave me.
He has since resigned from his role at the church.
Don't have to look far back to October of 2024. Zachary Radcliffe, a megachurch worship leader, youth pastor in Michigan, and also a performer at the Conservative Political Action Conference. He's arraigned on multiple felonies, including sexual abuse of children, facing up to 25 years in prison. He faces 60 charges, and also that he solicited child sexual abuse material from a minor, victims ranging 12 to 17 years old. And then, of course, we had the nomination of Matt Gaetz, the only one of Trump's nominees that actually got shot down, because he was too odious even for the Republicans to support him. Matt Gaetz, who was showing pictures of the teenagers that he was raping to his fellow congresspeople on the floor of the House, Venmoing them payments. And that was someone that Trump thought ought to be the attorney general. The entire MAGA movement is just rife with these sexual abusers. Tim Ballard is another one of them. This is from October of last year. Tim Ballard, the MAGA influencer. He's the one that made a film called The Sound of Freedom that is an anti-sex trafficking film. He himself has been facing multiple allegations of sexual abuse and human trafficking. How about David Todeschini? He's the QAnon influencer who was busted. He was convicted of abusing an 8-year-old boy back in 1999. And yet comes forth with these films to allege that Democrats are running the secret QAnon pedophile ring. And we also have the return of Andrew Tate and his brother. Andrew Tate, who's been in Romania facing sex trafficking charges and sexual abuse charges, Trump managed to spring him from Romania and bring him back into the United States. Now, some of the MAGA are upset about this. A lot of them bought into this whole Democratic pedophile ring thing, and in doing so, bought into the Jeffrey Epstein thing. How Jeffrey Epstein had the Lolita Express, his plane, flying well-known people to his little pedophile island. And there's been calls to release the Epstein files. That was one of the things Trump, you know, we're going to release the Epstein files. The truth will come out about the pedophiles. But now, it's been just a dog and pony show. They gave a bunch of binders to Pam Bondi. She went and released the binders. Turns out it was nothing that hadn't already been seen before, just basically a collection of all the court records and testimonies that everyone had already seen before. And some of the MAGA out here are like, hey, where's the Epstein files? How come this is such a shit show? How come we can't get the Epstein files? Well, we know why. Because Donald Trump's name is all over them, as well as probably a whole bunch of other prominent conservatives. So now, Trump has the New York FBI field office, an office that has over 1,000 agents and another 1,000 or so civilian employees. The New York field office that's the epicenter for FBI's counterintelligence, counterterrorism, public corruption, international drug trafficking, and financial crime investigations, according to Vanity Fair. Those guys, the couple thousand of people there that would take care of those pressing priorities, have now been reassigned to the Jeffrey Epstein files for redaction purposes. One source familiar with the matter says it's literally all hands on deck, and dozens of agents are working round the clock to redact the Epstein files. Yeah, so
We know how that's going to turn out. They're going to be redacting every MAGA influencer, every conservative commentator and pundit, every Republican elected they can find in those files, and then leave any of the rest of them that might happen to be Democrats, looking at you, Bill Clinton, leave that out there to be able to smear the other party. Folks, MAGA is the pedophile party. Don't let them try to fool you on this. And whatever you do, keep your kids as far away from them as possible.
And it goes down smooth. Hey!
All right, folks, that's all the time we got for today. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. I hope you're enjoying March Madness out there. I was just barely aware that it was happening. I saw a headline that said Drake might be going to a Sweet 16, and I thought, oh, no! Like, oh, no, Drake, the basketball team. Okay, got it. Sweet 16, the part of the tournament. Okay, that's better. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons Share Alike Licensing. A minor. The main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by freestockmusic.com and VTEMO, courtesy of freetouse.com/music. You can contact me by email at radicalruss@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as @radicalruss.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially if you wish by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at radicalruss.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other.